This time on the show, this is a slow pitch up the middle.
What can I do to be a huge star?
And my dad was the Mexican Bill Cosby. All this and more on Comics Are Great. It's Comics Are Great, the visual storytelling show recorded live every other Wednesday at the Ann Arbor District Library in lovely downtown Ann Arbor, Michigan, comics.aadl.org. And this is the show where we talk about visual storytelling, making comics, writing stories, communicating visually, the lifestyle of people who, creative people who make things visually, all the stuff that surrounds this medium that drives us all mad. My name is Jersey Drozd, cartoonist and teaching artist. With me today, we're going to talk about being positive, the power of positive, and how to straddle the line between being funny and being positive. And I'm so excited to have on the show for the first time, but we've known each other for a long time, Jim Lujan of jimlujan.com. Hey, Jim.
Hey, Jersey. I'm a big fan. Have all your albums.
you're thinking of the guy who makes the basses, then.
Oh, sorry.
But I have all of your albums. You are a cartoonist, animator, filmmaker. You make music. You do it all. If you go to jimlujan.com, you can get to the YouTube page. So you do a lot of animated cartoons. Gosh, how many are on there now on your YouTube channel?
On there, I think there's about 40 or 35 or something like that, but I've done over 50.
Holy moly. And all by yourself. And I want to talk, that's where I want to start with this, is talking about your process.
Mostly, yeah. I use guest stars. I mean, some of the guest stars are just amazing voice talents that do a wonderful work. Wonderful work, Jersey. Just
yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, hey, didn't you do one? It just struck me right now.
You know what's funny? I forgot that I was in one of your cartoons.
Yes.
You actually didn't I appear in a cartoon with Mark Rudolph at one
yes.
point?
And Kevin Cross and a few other folks. I had Jersey play it was just a real quick like couple of lines, but you were a music critic.
That's right.
Actually have a clip of that to play if we want to watch it real quick.
So Matt does his research, and Matt grabbed a clip of from March of the Swizzle Stick Army. You want to pull it up, Matt, and we'll just sit quiet?
Live from Miami, I'm backstage partying with one of the hottest bands in the land, the Swizzle Stick Army. How are you guys liking Miami so far?
I do not like your question, and you must be maced.
Welcome back to Crosstalk. Bad behavior and blistering beats. What's the verdict on the Swizzle Stick Army?
Their music transcends pop or avant-garde noise rock. It's a dichotomy of primal catharsis. I like the drums. They're cool.
What do you think about the treatment the band's been getting on your trip here to Florida?
Florida? You make a big deal about throwing a television set out of a window, yet you let your alligators roam wildly on the streets. I speak for the band, Hans, Fritz, and Hans, when I say that we are both repulsed and disgusted by Florida. The orange juice is good, that's it.
So, the it's one of my favorite gags, is the when the lead singer of the Swizzle Stick Army is saying, you know, he's poo-pooing Florida, and he's saying how terrible Florida is and how much they hate Florida. Then there's a pause.
The orange juice is good, but that's it.
That's like a Jim Lujan joke right there. That happened.
That's their manager. His name is the Trout. The Trout.
Leute.
But okay, so there was an example of the kind of cartoons that you do. I mean, you've got a lot on there, like Freak Daddy. John Henry Unicorn was a big one. That was a really, really cool one. And there was more than one John Henry Unicorn, right?
Yes. And for those that don't know, John Henry Unicorn is my cartoon about a sort of a cult leader. And there was John Henry Unicorn, which is the first one. And then there was Day of the Unicorn.
That's right.
Which was a prison film. And I think that was it. Then I did a third one that he was featured in called, and I love this title, and thank you, Bill Moran, my friend, for saying this phrase on accident, Faith Healing Through Superior Firepower is the title of that third cartoon, and that's kind of the trilogy. We were in a car, and I was talking with my friend Bill, and I don't know what we were talking about, but he made a joke, like, because some kind of diplomacy through, you know, like let's go get him.
Right.
He just said real nonchalantly, he was like, yeah. He goes, faith healing through superior firepower, like that. And I was like, hold on, let me write that down.
So, okay, let's jump on that, because you did that when we were just doing the pre-show, just kicking things around a little bit. This is, like, you're always carrying a notebook with you?
No. I'm at my office, so I have it right here.
Oh. But I do
once in a while will write down names or band names, and some of them are ridiculous and will never be used. But
give me one of the ones that will never be used.
Oh, God. All right, hold on. Let me look at my phone. Well, they might be used, but one of the band names that that I don't know where this came from. There's my idea for a punk band was Mary Tyler Whore.
I could already see the high contrast Xerox posters nailed to the telephone pole for that one.
One of my favorite bands, Coyote Turd, and they're a good one. And then there's Haircut Reward. those are really good bands. To go to what we were talking about earlier, before we started broadcasting, Jersey mentioned that he had. The other night, he had a stress nightmare from puppets.
Right. Okay. So let's deconstruct this. Now, why was that so funny to you? Like, what is it about that particularly grabbed you?
It was so real. You just said, oh, yeah, and the other night I had a stress nightmare from puppets. And in my mind, I just started thinking, like I told you this, that's something an angry father would say at the breakfast table. Like, Tyler, eat your oatmeal. Don't you realize I had a stress nightmare from puppets? You know, it's just like so ridiculous that. So yes, I did write that down as well. Harris, death nightmare from puppets, and the fact that you said it so honestly, it's just Jersey. That's Jersey right there. I like that.
But I think it's interesting about that is that it's a moment. It's a teachable moment of learning. Like, how does somebody identify what is comedy material and what isn't? Right.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's not necessarily. Well, let me ask you. How much of making your cartoons, because most of your cartoons are very, very funny, and you can tell it's intended. You're not a dramatist necessarily or a documentarian. These are like really satirical and funny cartoons. How much of this is like grinding through the joke and like grinding through iterations of the joke, and how much of it is like just listening to life and finding interesting things and then pulling them out?
I think an average cartoon that I do starts from a kernel of an idea that I end up kind of sticking with. Like Stress Nightmare from Puppets is probably not going to be the title of a new cartoon, but it might appear as a line in one.
Right.
A lot of times are character-driven, too. It's the if I have a certain character, I did one called Prince of Pomona.
Won an award, by the way.
Yes.
Yeah.
The Nomi.
Oh, yeah, the Nomi right behind somewhere, you there on the bureau.
And that cartoon was driven by a character that in modern day times, and he's a white character, he lives his life as Prince, except he works at a yogurt shop. But he has a little motorcycle or a bike or whatever, and he wears his hair like Prince did in 1984. So he's living out like the Purple Rain superhero fantasy. And I just thought, to me, that idea, I'm going to give an exclusive. Originally, the original title I have written down in this little notebook for this, I had it just popped in my head, The White Prince of Pomona. And I don't know why. I saw something or something, and I just, at one time, I wrote that down, The White Prince of Pomona. Maybe it was like the Fresh Prince of Bel Air or something that, you know, subconsciously. But so it started from there. And then I thought, what would his name be? Oh, Purple Ron. Because, you know, and then it just kind of, it snowballed from there. So on that particular one, the jokes sort of wrote themselves as the events unfolded in his line. It's a very short cartoon. But see how the character kind of spawns that, you know, and so I don't often hit any many walls when I'm writing, which is, could be good and could be bad, but it's usually the characters, you know, kind of, it sounds so corny and cliche. Oh, the characters write themselves. And
it does sound, you know, cliche,
but it's true. It's actually true.
Yeah. But because I noticed that when I'm doing freelance writing for gigs, I'll get some creative constraints where they say, we want it to be about this and take place here. Right. And then I'm like, well, what can I do with that? What can I do with that? And I, you know, grind through a bunch of different ideas. None of them really compel me. The moment I say, what does this character want? Right. And why would they want that? And how do they mess it up? Then all of a sudden I start getting into really interesting places with like working through the freelance gig within the constraints that they have. Right.
Because otherwise it could be forced. If you just start writing, I don't know, if you don't think about that stuff at all, then you can, it just sounds fake. Like a person wouldn't do that, you know?
Yeah.
And then if you do the opposite, if you think too much about it, then it becomes like an exercise in just like self-indulgence a little bit. So in the middle somewhere is where the sweet spot is for that.
What do you mean when you like self-indulgence? How, like when you
think if like, for example, if let's use Star Wars for an example.
Okay.
If how it would have been a way less good film if they would have spent another half an hour on Luke's going, why can't I go to Tosche Station?
Right.
You know, let's think about that. Why can't I, you know? And then like him arguing with Uncle Ben for like, you know, well, you didn't clean your room last week, Luke, and I told you,
you didn't clean your space room.
That, like the dynamic between them for, you know, another 30, 40 minutes.
Right.
It would have, you know, it would have been a different film.
Shut up, Uncle Owen. You don't know me.
You touched me, Uncle Owen.
I wasn't going there. I was thinking of him putting on space headphones, then turning on like the record player and locking the door, but...
That's what you have robots for.
Oh, jeez. All right. So, okay. I want to talk a little bit about I don't want to talk about your process, Jim. But I do want to talk about your process.
I don't mind. My process.
Well, it's interesting to me that... because we talked about this years ago, back in the Art and Story days. Like, you were doing a podcast, actually, called Ghettomation.
Mm-hmm.
And you had a Ghettomation website, which was, like, this kind of cheering this idea of, you know, kind of like the punk rock ethos of making animation. Like, you don't need a big fancy studio to do it, right?
Yeah.
Use what you got. And back then, you were doing everything, am I correct? You were doing everything in Flash, right?
Back then is still back now. I just do it a little bit better, I think.
Yeah.
Not drawn in Flash. I always have to clarify that. I use Flash as an animating software, but I don't draw anything in Flash.
What do you draw on? Because if I remember right, you were drawing like on anything back in the days of John Henry Unicorn and March of the Sadistic Army.
I am drawing in these right here, sketchbooks. So, and these are normally what I use to do my cartoons in and such, and I scan them and color them in. However, in this latest film that I did, Foreverland, I got one of these stylists, a bamboo stylist, and I started cheating and pretty soon it went from being 10%. 20%, then it jumped to like I do about 60% of my stuff electronically. Yeah. I still draw in the sketchbook. I'll never stop because you can travel with a sketchbook. You can't travel with an iMac and a bamboo unless you get a laptop.
Oh.
No, I wouldn't do that. It's just more trouble than it's worth.
Yeah.
Because when the Terminators come and take our machines away from us and they turn on us, then how will I do my cartoons then?
Because all those digital artists are going to be like, "What is this paper thing? I don't know what to do with this. This is nonsense, right?" But you'll still have your chops. You'll still be attuned to concert pitch and drawing on paper. But that is interesting that you are finally drawing 60% digitally.
Yeah.
But you're animating this entire, and we're going to talk about this feature that you just did, Counterclockwise in Foreverland, which is an hour long. Like all the other films that we talked about were fairly short, like what, 10 yeah. minutes?
Yeah, the longest film I had done previously was 18 minutes.
Okay.
And that was Bobby Churro. I have a long version of that.
But this
That's
is
a boxing movie.
56 minutes, 57 minutes, this film. This is a big undertaking. And I mean, I wonder if I could just play the trailer, Matt, for Counterclockwise in Foreverland.
Yep, I've got it queued up.
All right, here we go. I think that's Swizzle Stick Army.
Muy fun fest!
Matt's gonna pull up the trailer. Here we go.
Actually, all my cartoons look the same. It's just I changed the voices.
Yeah, sorry about that. I do have the other one queued up now. Sorry.
I'm over it. It's okay.
Yeah, you can get me a screwdriver on the rocks. Yo, jam that screwdriver in my ear because this music is terrible.
Ooh, look, Deacon. Madame Mesmeralda.
Long ago, there was a glove. A glove that brought joy and music throughout the universe. This glove was powered by love and positive energy. But I must tell you now that dark forces have retrieved this glove. And they are using it to suppress the power of positivity. The universe is out of order. And it is your job to set the clock right. Turn it counterclockwise.
Oh, hell no.
Lord, that booty make me want to slap my mama.
Okay, so as we saw with that trailer, not only is this thing 56 minutes long, but it was like an epic undertaking in terms of, you know, crowd scenes, action scenes. You have armies of people going to war in this movie. You have a whole bunch of different settings. It takes place in Cleveland. It takes place in this place called Foreverland. Let's start with like the elevator pitch for what the film is first, then we can dig into like what it took to make it.
We did three videos. I did three videos for Counterclockwise: Moonwalk, Outside the Lines, and Whip. And during the making of the first video, Moonwalk, we started. It was such an easy collaboration. We clicked right away. They gave me full creative, you know, freedom. They said run wild with it. And after the first video, the character Mr. Creep, the guy with the white hat and stuff. We were saying, wow, what a great villain. We should kind of put him in each of these videos a little bit, or hide, you know, have a theme going somehow. And then it turned into, we should do a movie one day. We should do a movie one day. And that turned into, we were on a podcast together, Fanboy Radio, and the host Scott Hines, who ended up being in the movie as Infinitus. He asked them a question. They were the guests, and he asked them, so what's going on? What's your next project? And they said, we're doing a movie with Jim Lujan. Like they announced it right there. And I was on the phone. I was on the call with them, and I thought, why not? You know, they let the cat out the bag. We might as well let the cat run free. And so the way we built this movie was kind of 4 minutes at a time. So it's like in little sections. I built it kind of like a painting. When I had time to work on it, I'd work on it. If I didn't, it went to the side. And I had a little time, I'd work on it. So it really was one of those how to eat an elephant a bite at a time. We built this a bite at a time, and they added so much to the film as well. I mean, their personalities, a lot of their ad libs, a lot of their, you know, their music, you know. And
yeah,
and
we should say this is a musical fantasy adventure too.
Yeah, yeah. And we really collaborated too, because I would send them stuff and they would add stuff to it, and they would send me stuff and I would add stuff to it. So it happened very naturally, and just when I could work on it.
So let me start with this question, because this is something that I'm trying to train myself to do, is that I tend to, when I see impressive undertakings, is that I, like a lot of people, I'll say like, oh man, how hard was that? Rather, I think the more interesting question is, how fun was that to do?
Yeah.
Something with that much variety of location, setting, and then also like one of the most over the top villains I've ever seen in your films, in terms of Infinitus, played by Scott Hines, who, gosh, you know, when I was watching it, if I didn't know it was him, I would have thought it was Paul F. Tompkins. It yeah. sounded so similar in the performance. It was eerily similar.
And he was it. I mean, he did everything. We call him One Take Hines. He did everything so quickly because I wanted Scott Hines. You know, I wanted exactly what he brought to it is exactly why I cast him as that, because it was perfect for when, you know, he didn't have to try to do, you know, anything too uncomfortable. He was like, be funny, attack it the way you want to attack it. Mm-hmm. And we did have fun doing it. That was the key of it. We had a lot of fun making this. And this is one of those projects where I'm sure there's people working at studios and animation studios that would say, man, I wish I could do my own thing and I would just have total freedom. Well, that's where we're at right now. We have total freedom, so we might as well make the most of it. So that's kind of where we're at with it.
But, you know, I talk with other cartoonists who are, you know, they've got a day job as cartoonists and then they clock out and it's like, gosh, you know, either A, I don't feel the energy. I feel like it's creatively spent from my day job to put any time into working on the stuff at night. Or they'll say, you know, I don't have the time to make it really good as I do for my day job as a cartoonist or as a designer or anything. Whatever kind of day job you got. Like, there's this whole mystery around the time and energy constraints of doing something that is totally your creative passion project. So how do you keep it fun enough to do to make it so that it's not those things to you?
Well, approaching it like 4 minutes at a time really helped.
Yeah.
Because we did this in sprints, and then we just tied a bunch of these little sprints together and it turned into a marathon. So that was a way of keeping the energy fresh, was just working on it a small piece at a time. We didn't get overwhelmed, and I mean, really, truly, when there was a time toward the end when I was like, man, I'm like running on fumes trying to finish this, because there was a couple of other projects that happened during the middle of this, which actually delayed Foreverland, and I remember thinking, man, okay, this is the time where you gotta like kind of just suck it up and finish it, and by doing that, I found a new energy at the end, because at the end, I think I had more fun than even at the beginning. Like the last, you know, and Foreverland was built in sequence. So the first thing you see in it, Foreverland, the opening shot, is the first thing I did for it.
So you did not board this whole thing out in advance?
No, not at all. There, some scenes, it was done scene by scene, and some scenes I would kind of do thumbnails for. And then some scenes, none. Like some scenes were just built. I'm gonna see if I can find a thumbnail for you. Some scenes were just completely built on the fly, you know. So, let me see. Here's an example. These thumbnails take weeks and weeks to do.
I bet. Holy cow.
So, and because I'm working on it myself, I don't have somebody here that I need to translate the method to.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I'm able to do like these super cryptic, you can't even tell what they are, thumbnails, because I know what they mean.
They were readable. That's the thing, is that you're doing it all on your own, and that also sounds like incredibly daunting to say, like, oh my gosh, I'm gonna animate something entirely by myself with armies racing at each other and stuff. So Okay, so you found, but over the years you found a approach that works for you in this sketching in the sketchbooks, scanning into Flash. There's a style to your animation that I think is like essentially Jim Lujan. You're not doing Pinocchio here. You're doing much more limited stuff than Pinocchio. And what I'm curious about is, and I mean, anybody who watched the video saw that. So my next thought is how does that affect the choices that you make in terms of what projects you take on? Like, is there a thing where you're like, well, that's not a Jim Lujan thing either because, you know, it's technically too demanding, or it doesn't have the voice that I want. It doesn't have the spirit that I want. Like, how do you know? Like, okay, I'm layering on.
I know
like 12,
what you mean. I know yeah. you mean. Like, yeah, like what's the criteria?
Yeah.
Well, for Foreverland, even though it's huge, epic sci-fi, it just has to have my spin on it. It had to be in my style. And just use that as an advantage. I was just talking with somebody the other day and about my level of animation. And even if I had every resource in the world, I would only boost my animation by about 50%, you know, another 50%. It wouldn't have that much more movement. It would be done, you know, a little bit more, you know, the animation would have more animation, but it wouldn't be Walt Disney. It's just not meant to be for what it is. It has a certain look. I would say, you asked me earlier too about if somebody has a project that is daunting, like where am I going to get the time?
Yeah.
I would say part of the criteria for your project should be what you can do, not just what you want to do, but what you can do now. So, if you can only do a certain level of animation right now, do a project that calls upon that certain level of animation. There's something that I keep in mind too when I'm animating. It looks worse to have a really well animated, realistic movement that's a little bit off than it does to have something that's way off and has a little bit of realism. You know what I mean? It's
yeah. I know
the
exactly.
Human eye looks at that and goes, that looks creepy, you know.
It's an Uncanny Valley thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It could, because like, when you get about, you know, get into any of your films, the there's a consistency in the way you do it that makes it plausible so that I'm not going, well, why did the guy's hand, like, well, for instance, there's a scene where a character's slapping another character in the film. And, you're not seeing the full arm swing. It's sort of like arm here, arm here, arm here. But at that point in the film, like, I'm so signed on to this world and the context that you've built through the way that you animate it, that I didn't even think twice about it, right? And, like, I made a note because I'm watching it analytically, like, I got to follow up on this with Jim. But as I'm watching it, it's like it's not a realistic movement, but I believe it. Does that
Jersey,
make sense?
Jersey, I spent $200,000 to do that scene. I used motion capture.
You put the golf balls on somebody?
We had to mortgage our house.
Sorry, Jim.
I'm very hurt right now.
Oh, my God. Okay, I want to round back on something else you said earlier when you talked about how this thing started counterclockwise in Foreverland. You've been doing the circuit, and you were on, you did a Fanboy Radio special, or it was a Foreverland special, which people can find at jimlujan.com. You were on Independent Road with Peter Palmiotti. You were on, what was the geek podcast that you were on, Last Geek Stand?
Jack of All Nerds.
Jack of All Nerds, yes. You were also on that recently. So listen to all those, and everybody should, because Jim is a marvelous storyteller and a really pleasant guy to listen to. It helped me get through my workday, made me feel good about life. But one of the things you talked about in one of those other interviews is you said, counterclockwise said that they found you because you were just doing your own thing. They were just looking through YouTube, found these really cool cartoons on YouTube, and said, hey, this guy's awesome. We should get him to do a music video. And then they approach you.
Yeah, yeah. That's exactly how it happened. And I've been approached to do animation for music videos before, but a lot of times when you click on the links, it's something I can't do this. Like, the songs are really, why do I attract these people? And when they sent, well, there's kind of a double-sided thing. When they sent Deacon sent me the email. He said, I'm a big fan. And through talking to him, he was mentioning specific things about my cartoons, which right there, my ego went.
Yeah.
Like, wow, this guy knows my stuff and he's an actual fan of my stuff. And then the other thing was that sealed the deal is when I went and listened to their music, I was like, okay, I'm going to jump on this before somebody else does because they're that legit. Like, they're that versatile and interesting and spacey and weird and fun. And so I thought, this is a slow pitch up the middle. So, and then add to that the creative freedom, you know. So right off the bat, we said, okay, we're going to do 3 music videos. And then the rest kind of happened naturally. And I use that word a lot. It was organic and natural. That's how this whole thing happened. It just snowballed. So when we had fun with it. So,
well, what I did not hear at any point during your story is, oh boy, I better do this because it'll really help my career, or oh, I better do this because it'll be good exposure. Oh, I better do this because I need more people to see my work. This was something where it sounds to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, Jim, it was pretty selfishly motivated when you were responding to this request. It was like,
no, I just thought this is good for me. And I pushed them to the side. In fact, do you guys really need to be in these things? Can I just animate myself?
No, but you know,
no. Honestly, there's that thought. Anytime, just like when they contacted me, I'm sure they thought, oh, this will be so good that people will jump onto it. But see, that's the whole thing.
Yeah.
If you approach something, I think anybody on any level, if they approach something where they say, I believe in this so much and this is going to be so good that this is going to make me a huge star, there's nothing wrong with that. But if you think, if you sit and go, well, what can I do to be a huge star? Then that's when you start making fun of Kim Kardashian and you know, and whatever's the flavor of the month thing to make fun of. And that's fine. And there's room for that, but that's just not where this came from. But there was that thought in it, Jersey. We wanted the whole point of doing Foreverland it encompasses this. One of the points for doing Foreverland was for other eyeballs to see this and for somebody to see it and say, hey, we want to distribute this, you know, on a wider level, or we want to make a television show about this, or whatever, you know, we want to make electric blankets with your, you know.
Of course. But it's interesting to me that, like, as a guy who, you know, I think anybody in the creative arts, like, you go to a comic convention, you're tabling, you're going to meet that guy or gal who comes up to you and says, hey, I've got a brilliant idea for a new comic. You should draw it for me. We've never met. And they're not necessarily familiar with my work, but they just want to get an artist, right? And they just want to, they're out there pitching, trying to find a collaborator. And, you know, I talk to young or beginning cartoonists who will say things like, well, you know, I don't have much on my resume yet. This could be a thing. And then I say, well, no, are you excited about it? Are you actually excited to do the thing? Have you read it? And are you responding to it in any way? Or are they a big fan of you? Are they coming to you because there's something unique in the way you do things that only you can bring what is needed to this thing? And then that would be satisfying to you as well, right? But when it's this kind of like cold call, like, hey, are you an artist? Would you like to draw something for somebody? Hey, I'm a really important person, and after all, you should work for me. What I heard in your story is that they were familiar with your work. They wanted what you could bring to their music. And then, yes, you think about the fame and the money and stuff afterwards, but what's initially, I think, interesting is that you went at it because it was exciting and compelling as a project to you, right?
Yeah, and it's just, speaking of music, it is like music, because if you have one musician that another musician comes and says, hey, we should write something together, we should record together, it excites them because they know what the end product could be, and I think we both kind of felt that. We both knew, like, wow, if we hook up, this could be really interesting and you know, something really good can come. And we're really happy with what came out and how fast and how easy, relatively speaking, easy it was. It's all in all, I'm very glad to be involved with something that does have a positive message to it.
Let's go there.
It's not corny, not positive, you know, where everything's sunshine and rainbows. It's got this dark, project, but it's like a car. It's this dark car with tinted windows slowly creeping around the corner, but then it opens up, and inside of it, My Pretty Pony jumps out.
That is an awesome metaphor for the experience of this film, and let's go there real quick, because I mean here's one of my favorite scenes from the film. Problems. I'm not going to spoil anything, by the way, but you know, some significant problems get solved towards the end of the film, and Infinitus is he's on the ropes. He's not defeated yet, but he's on the ropes. Things are looking bad for our villain. And then what happens in these kinds of stories, because Infinitus has, like, enslaved the world. There's all these great flags that say, bow down. What an awesome catchphrase for a supervillain. I mean, I know every supervillain says that, but nobody's ever put it on a flag, bow down.
Copyright.
But, and so now the oppressed people are turning on Infinitus, and it shows this this woman, and she says, Infinitus took my family. And the little boy says, he came to our village and took our toys away. All right, it's getting pretty corny. And then it switches to, Infinitus cut my hand off. Sucker came back and cut off my hook, too. What's up with that? So you diffuse, like, they're heading for, like, this corny, like, okay, the people are revolting against him. But then you slide in this joke to go, oh, but don't forget that we're having fun here, right?
Yeah. That's Oscar-worthy, too, by the way.
Sucker came back and cut my hook off. But what I think is the interesting thing here is that, well, and I should say also, like, there's like a lot of positive imagery. Like, there's like this magical flower in a cage that is like somehow tied into like this positive energy that needs to be released back into the land. But when the skull-headed guards show up and they're like, hey, hold it right there, that flower has laser eyes and burns the heads off of the skull warriors.
And I'll tell you. And there's a ton of Easter eggs in this. This is like the Shining of animation. There's so many. And we would have conversations, Deacon and Kaya and I, about, this kind of represents this and this represents that. And then a lot of times they would ask me, well, wait a minute, Jim. How if they're stuck in this situation, why don't they just do this? And I go, because what you didn't see off camera was so it just wrote itself.
But what I'm pointing at here is that I think is so fascinating is that you are a guy, and when I went back and looked at your older films, I was like, holy cow, it's been there the whole time. Is you're this guy who really straddles this line between being a satirist and mildly acerbic, but also really positive. Like, even in like things like the Swizzle Stick Army, which has a lot of like, you know, physical humor, people getting maced, and then
it's like a theme in my cartoons.
And then satirical humor, like, you know, like the army of characters that you bring on to like do send ups of, like the music critic, like the news people, and et cetera. And there's you make fun of news anchors in Foreverland as well. Having things like the villain reading Three Eyed Lady magazine sideways and stuff like that. You know, there's that stuff in there. There's that comedy thing. And like we were talking about before we started recording, is like the comedy tends to be characterized as something that is an attack on something. You are attacking a thing. You're sending it up. You're satirizing it. You're calling out its flaws and foibles in a safe and amusing way. So very rarely do you see like really positive comedy. You know, I can't think of many people who I would call a positive comic.
Huh.
You might be the only one.
I think my heroes, I have weird heroes. So, and you kind of try to emulate your heroes a lot. So my heroes are people like Andy Kaufman, mm-hmm, and Stanley Kubrick, and just Peter Criss. I don't know why I threw that in, but
because he never gets enough love and respect.
That's right. Yeah, he's the cat man. But we were just talking the other day about, I wish there was a term for my style of humor, because what it is it's not parody. It is a little bit satire, but it's exaggerated humor. That's what it is. So if you take somebody and you just completely exaggerate them, it's not so much absurdist. It's not Monty Python, and it's not quite Will Ferrell.
It's more like maybe like in the spectrum.
Monty Ferrell.
Weird Al Yankovic. Weird Al Yankovic is kind of in that spectrum a little bit. Like, but you don't have like hot dog, Twinkie hot dog things, silly food humor.
I mean, like the stress nightmare from Puppets. that epitomizes, that should be your autobiography title, by the way. But that's right there. That summarizes my, to me, what's funny. It's like, it's funny, but it's not supposed to be funny.
Well, that should be the title of my autobiography. It's funny, but it's not supposed to be funny. I'm sure this is like a natural place where you come from, because I, you know, we've hung out in real life, and like that was my first thing, was like, wow, he is such a sweet guy. But I mean, you know, part of being funny is like, you know, John Henry Unicorns making fun of a specific type of guy. I'll put it this way. Is it just a reflex of who you are, or is this something that you have to remind yourself of when you're writing your stories? Is like, you know, did I trip over into too dark a territory? Is there like some kind of mental check that you do to keep yourself on task?
The first one.
Okay, so it's just natural.
That's all I have to say. No.
Was it always that way?
I think so. Right now I'm thinking about when I was a kid, and my cousin Mike and I, we made up tons of songs. And one time, right when we first started, I was probably 11. No, I was 12 years old. We made up a song, and it was a cutesy, cutesy song. It was like a parody on like a mariachi song. But I didn't speak Spanish, so I would just make up words. And then we played that tape for my family. They thought, oh, how cute, how cute, how cute. But then they didn't know, like the next, and then we stopped the tape. And the next song up was a song called Dog Vomit and Monkey Puss. And they would not have thought that was so cute. So there's like a weird parallel there. There's that side, but then there's that side. But then again, I always had this fear, this phobia of my dad was a fireman, you know, very manly guy, but did not cuss. I don't know where that came from, his family or what, but he did not cuss. And you know, don't even dare cuss in our house, you know, and he did not like foul language. My dad was the Mexican Bill Cosby. He was. He looked like Bill Cosby, kind of. He's built like him, So I think that kind of gave me a guilt complex, because, you know, you either rebel against your parents and become exactly the opposite, or you just cower in shame and fear like I do and just do it secretly. You know, no, I mean, I think that's kind of where that limiter comes in within me, uh-huh. You know, because of how I was raised by my, you know. Now, if my mom had been a single mom, oh, I'd be a horrible guy. I mean, I just... She would have just let me do whatever. No.
You'd be on the streets right now. Okay, well, we got to get to book recommendations in a minute. Rachel's going to be in the studio in just a few minutes. But I do need to talk with you about this Revengeance thing.
Yes.
Because you, my friend, are working on a film with Bill Plimpton. Bill freaking Plimpton.
Yeah, how'd that happen?
Yeah, how did that happen? I mean, I'm guessing, here's my guess, and you correct me if I'm wrong. Doing your own thing, following your own passion and pursuing your own voice by making videos on YouTube, just making a lot of them, and then talking with people about them, led to more people seeing your stuff, and going to film festivals and pushing your stuff out there, trying to get more people to watch your things at film festivals, put you on the radar of this guy, Bill Plimpton, who looked at you and said, this kid's got something. He's got something that I think is interesting. Boy, it'd be interesting to work with him sometime. Is that how it went?
Yes, and there's people, specific people involved. Co-interviewed him, Bill Plimpton, with Raul Aguirre Jr. on the Man vs. Art podcast.
Man versus Art podcast. Everybody should listen to that too. That guy pulls no punches.
That's a great podcast. Ken Mora, our friend Ken Mora, he got us that opportunity through Alexia Anastasio and Kevin Michaels. They helped cultivate, you know, probably said nice things when I wasn't there to Bill. But ultimately, it came down to Bill watching my stuff and realizing, because I've done this with other people. I've come across artists that spark creativity within me. And I think maybe Bill watching my stuff and realizing that, oh, one guy is doing most of this. I think that kind of like, wow, this is cool. Like he was actually genuinely interested in my work. So that's how that happened. And then I met him a few times and I've never, ever, ever asked him for anything. I think I asked him to hand me a napkin one time. And I think that has something to do with it too. I wasn't pushy with him and I wasn't looking to like, oh, by being friends with Bill, I'll gain, you know, the kingdom.
Yes. I don't know how many times I've gone to conventions and you have those friends like Jim who just want to just talk with interesting people. And if something comes out of that relationship, great, but that's not the point. The point is just to have interesting interactions with interesting people. And then there's the people who lead with, like, who do you know? Who do you know that I should know? Because this is all about a ladder climb after all. This is a vertical thing, right? It's not a horizontal thing. Yeah. That is awesome.
There's a book I want to recommend.
Yes.
That Alexia Anastasio, she directed the documentary on Bill Plimpton, Adventures in Plimptoons. And she recommended a book to me called Never Eat Alone. It's by Keith Ferrazzi. And basically, to summarize this book, it's about networking without being a D-bag. it's about networking without just being a total fake and phony. Networking gets you everywhere because it is who you – ultimately, it is who you know. I don't care how good you are. Somebody has to go, okay, I'll let you on my network.
Well, it matters how good you are, but it also matters that people see this good stuff that you make, right?
Right, but if you keep that good stuff to yourself, nobody ever makes it alone.
Right.
Everybody has, even Prince has a team behind him. And you have to cultivate these relationships, but you have to be real, too. And I look back at, like, the good things that have happened, and it's happened because of networking in a real way, and at the same time, try to be as good as you can. Try to be so good that they can't deny you. Mm-hmm. You know, so the combination of those two things is a really helpful thing. So anybody starting out, too, people can smell desperation. Yeah. So even if you are desperate, don't act desperate. And then listen to the audiences. Listen to what they tell you about your work. Because if everybody tells you, I like your work, but everybody has buck teeth in your drawings. Think about that. Did you want to be known as the buck teeth cartoonist? Or, you know,
right.
If that's your thing, then go for it. But listen to the audience. Like, they don't argue with the audience. They're the final judge.
There's a sense sometimes I notice with the desperate type that you're talking about is that there's this kind of like agenda, and this interaction must have some kind of an outcome. There must be a takeaway. I must have some substantive change in my life after talking with this person, and there's like that pressure on. And when I talked with you, like when we were hanging out in Kentucky at the Up Fair a few years back, none of that was there. None of that was there. It was just this sense of what's happening around us. Are we responding to it, making comments on it, and making comments on each other's work? I remember one of the nicest things I've ever heard in my entire life was when we were at that Up Fair, and it was from you. And we don't have to bring it into the show, but it was this kind of like, there was no pressure for us to somehow, and we should work together, right? It was none of that kind of nonsense. It was like, it was just like a general appreciation of one another kind of thing.
See, by Jersey saying that, what I really said was, no, Jersey, I don't want to work with you. So he translated it. He kind of switched a few words around. But I understand. I get your point.
Look, Jim, when you live my life, you have to retcon everything.
Well, that's all I've got. I'm the master of analogies. I just thought of this one right now.
It's, okay.
As a creative artist, we're all in this ocean together, right? Everybody's floating in this ocean from, you know, and there's sharks in the water. There are sharks down there circling down there. What difference does it matter if you just float there and be cool about it? Or if you're the guy kicking your feet,
right?
You know, the sharks can tell.
Right.
So in other words, if you, everybody's desperate. We're all desperate artists. I probably, probably the most successful artist you can think of is still probably has a, there is a level of desperation there because he wants to continue it.
Yeah.
But the thing is, to quote Fonzie, be cool, shortcake. because it, what difference does it matter at the end of the day? If you act like a desperate person and you're looking for every opportunity and you'll step over everybody and on their throat, you know, what's the difference if you're that guy or just a guy like, look, when opportunities happen, I'll go after them. I'll be aggressive, but I'm not going to be desperate.
Right.
If the answer is no, I'm cool. I'll go walk away. You know,
you just, that was a really nice, succinct way to sum up the distinction is there's a difference between being aggressive and desperate. Right.
Because we're all desperate. Everybody's desperate.
Yeah. So this film, Revengeance, is coming out. You guys are going to be doing a trailer or a preview at San Diego Comic-Con.
That's what I hear. Yeah. We're right now at the very early stages of it. I wrote the script. Bill has the script, and he's finishing up another project right now. And then he's going to start work on it in the next couple of months. We were talking about we'd like to have something to show the audience, a preview at Comic-Con. And I think this is going to be another Foreverland, except Bill is going to be the Jim Lujan in this one. I think because he's doing the drawing and the animating. And I think I'm designing and doing a lot of voices and a lot of music for it. And what can I say about it? It's so early on. Now I know how J.J. Abrams feels. it's so early on. It's like, timelines are, I could just say I'm not at liberty to discuss the timelines. Right. But I would guesstimate that we're going to have something for Comic-Con. And what I can tell you, though, is I really do believe this film will not disappoint Bill Plimpton fans, but at the same time will open up a lot of eyeballs. It's very 70s grindhouse, you know, but it's going to be a PG-13. It won't be an R, but it's very wild and tons of characters, tons and tons of, there's action in it. There's all kinds of fun stuff that's going to happen in it. And there's lots of motorcycles
that you don't have to draw. Thankfully,
I don't have to draw. He said he liked to draw motorcycles, and I hope he meant that.
He's got to be the only person on the planet to ever say that.
Yeah, well, he's the guy loves drawing. The guy lives to draw. He can draw for hours. He's been quoted many times as saying, like, oh, he'll wake up at 5 a.m., start working on something for about 5 hours, go to lunch or whatever, come back, work for another, 4 hours, go home, have dinner, spend some time, then at night work another, 5-6 hours, and I used to think that sounds incredibly crazy, but then when I had the opportunity to do it with Foreverland, it's like I realized, okay, that's how, because when you sit down to start creating, the time just flies. It goes flies away. So yeah, I understand that.
Especially when you're working on something you're actually excited to do. And Bill Plimpton's one of those guys who's kind of led the charge, and like, I'm not going to do anything that compromises what my vision or my style or my approach
right
is.
It's got to
be good.
And I hope I can take some of the load off of his shoulders when the time does come to promote it, because I will be a podcasting harlot.
Well, you'll come back on yes. Comics are great. I would just want to do it just to talk with you anyway. I want to, after the experience is over, what I'm really curious about, and this we'll earmark this for future discussion, is navigating the relationship with a hero when you finally get to work with them. Like, how do you do that? Yeah. Like, I'm working on a book right now with one of my personal heroes, and it was a struggle to go from, how deferential should I be? This guy's the
Wait
master.
A minute. I thought John Wayne Gacy died. Am I mistaken? I'm sorry.
Look for it this September, everybody. Okay, actually, it was Tanya Harding. Gosh.
She can't write. Come on now.
Well, I'm ghosting for her. I think that's a whole other fascinating ball of wax, but we'll get to that next time. But for now, we got to do book recommendations. Oh, I want to give you a final thought before we go into book recommendations, Jim. Anything that we missed?
I just gave my wife a kiss. She's leaving me. Oh. That was good. Most people pay for that on a webcam. Hey, I have a book recommendation.
Okay, you can go first.
Can I really recommend a couple? Okay.
Yes, please. All right, while you get those, I'll introduce Rachel Moyer, who is here from the Ann Arbor District Library.
Hey.
Hey, Rachel. Is your mic on?
No, is it on?
Now it's on. Now it's on. So you are a PLA at the Ann Arbor District Library. You are taking over more and more of the responsibilities of the comics events happening here.
Yes.
And some neat stuff going on at comics.aadl.org.
Hopefully even more neat stuff in the future. We're kind of trying to add more stuff to it. So if you have any suggestions for things you want to see on our website, if you could email me at comics@aadl.org, that would be awesome because I am drowning in lists of resources and books and DVDs and all sorts of things to recommend to people. So,
yes, go to comics.aadl.org or email comics@aadl.org.
Almost exactly the same, so that's confusing, but, makes it easy to remember. Just change one punctuation mark.
Yeah, change the punctuation mark to an ampersand. So what books did you want to recommend this week?
All right.
Hi, Rachel.
Hey there.
So, Rachel, what do you got?
All right. First, I've got Supergirl, Cosmic Adventures in the Eighth Grade, which is one of those kind of books that, it's aimed at people that still think eighth grade sounds awesome. But it is an awesome book. It's kind of a little more wacky than I think most comics aimed at like younger girls tend to be. It plays with Supergirl's origin a little bit. This is a Supergirl who, instead of being, another last survivor of Krypton, she climbed in her parents' rocket. And in this case, Argo, where Supergirl is from, is not another place that ended up being destroyed. It's not the city. It's a moon. And it's in a different dimension, but it's still okay. It's still all there. But she gets mad at her parents and because they won't let her go to something, just standard teenager problems.
Okay.
And her dad's sending a rocket across dimensions to send a message to Superman, and she gets angry and hides in it and then ends up stranded on Earth and has to...
So this is non-canonical.
Definitely non-canonical, which is why it's kind of great. It's kind of like poor Supergirl... It just kind of had a hissy fit, ended up on Earth, and now has to deal with, all the standard problems of school, but they're kind of turned up to 11 because, she doesn't know that, you have New York City in New York State. Is there a New York country as well? And everyone's laughing at her all the time. She can't control her powers. But...
So she's the odd duck new kid, but even more odd duck new kid.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
But it's a lot of fun. It was... Unfortunately, another one of those kid series that was pretty short-lived. I think it was only 6 issues, but it is a really, really great comic to give to younger girls, especially if you want to, convince them to join our group, which is kind of what I have done with several young cousins, but they love it.
Let me ask you this, because I was just reading, Brianne Drewhart was recently at the Emerald City Comic Con, and she was posting some really awesome sketches of Wonder Woman, and she told the story about these little girls who were schooling her on Wonder Woman mythology, that Wonder Girl is not her only sister, okay. I guess a lot of the parents were saying, thank you for, being here and doing this, because our daughters don't have many superheroes for them.
Right.
Now, you were a young girl. You read superhero comics. Did that cross your radar, or were you just thinking, Superman is so great?
Well, there was that. I think because of where I fell in terms of, the development of the cartoons associated with DC Comics especially, a lot of the stuff that when I was, 7th grade on... that stuff was the Bruce Timm stuff. So I had Justice League and the Teen Titans cartoon, which isn't Bruce Timm, but was also, they've got Starfire and Raven, and you've got Hawkgirl and Wonder Woman. And so there was a little bit more of that, I think. Right now, it's a little weird right now, I think, in terms of DC animation, because, you have the Young Justice was actually extremely popular with girls. And then you get... these articles coming out from the creators of that cartoon saying, hey, we kind of got canceled partially because of that, because of that's what a huge portion of our audience was, and that's not what Cartoon Network was looking for. So, I don't know. it's always a toss up. I think a lot of, at least people in their young 20s, people my age right now, girls, are looking a lot more towards stuff that's not mainstream comics. You'll see a lot of people getting really excited about webcomics, and that because that is a much more female dominated sphere in comics.
Well, more representation, at least.
For sure. And then I have so many people who have been super excited about stuff like Carol Danvers versus Captain Marvel, or the new Ms. Marvel, or upcoming from Boom, the Lumberjanes series that's going to be coming out. That one's getting a lot of people excited because it's kind of, you know, Gravity Falls times. I don't remember what I've heard it like explained as Gravity Falls plus like Scooby-Doo sort of thing, plus Girl Scouts. Like it's all girls at a summer camp with supernatural mystery sort of thing. But, you know, I don't know that DC is putting out a lot of stuff right now that would be in the same kind of...
Right. Like something for 11-year-old girls.
Yeah. In terms of like the younger kids, like that middle school, pre-middle school, I think is kind of an underserved bracket in terms of superhero stuff.
That makes this that much more special.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Right? Because, you know, you can give even younger kids something like Tiny Titans or any of like the like the readers type stuff with, you know, the big heroes. You've got like Learn to Read with Superman or Batman or Wonder Woman. But there's kind of like a desert, a dry area there that I think Supergirl and Cosmic Adventures in the 8th grade kind of slots right in there. It's sort of like the transition period that might, you know, keep them actually interested in it as they go on. But
Oh, cool.
I don't know.
All right. Well, so there's at least this and there's a few others. But
there
I
are,
get
there
to
are definitely... quite a few other sorts of things like this. You just kind of, you have to be in the know. It's a little difficult to find them sometimes. I know I recommended Thor the Mighty Avenger. I think that kind of fits in there
I think
as
so
well.
Too.
So
this other one, this one is not for 11-year-old girls, or is it?
Which one am I grabbing first?
Full Metal.
Oh, okay. Okay, Full Metal Alchemist. This is one of those mangas that I feel like I forget to recommend to people because I just assume that everyone knows about it and loves it as much as I do because it's such... both a really popular work and a really quality work. So I'm just going to pretend no one knows what it is.
Okay.
So Full Metal Alchemist, it takes place in a world where you have this really developed science that functions almost as magic called alchemy. And it centers around the Elric brothers who commit a taboo in alchemy. They're really highly advanced for their age, young boys, commit this taboo because of something really tragic that's happened in their life. And it ends up with one of them losing an arm and a leg and the other one being like thrown out of his body entirely. And he gets basically trapped in a suit of armor. So it starts out as their quest to regain their bodies, but it develops much, much more than that. It's hard to boil it down, like what this is about, because it's about so many things.
It's a thick book, and this is just the first three
volumes.
Oh,
that's the first three volumes. There's 27 volumes total.
Holy moly.
Yeah, and you know, you hear that, you hear, 27 volumes, that's a lot. And you think, you're so hit and miss with long manga like that about how loose the storytelling gets. But Full Metal Alchemist is amazing because it's that long, but it's really tight storytelling. There's not much in there that I think you could take out without really damaging the quality of the story.
Wow.
And like I said, it's hard to say just what it's about because it's about everything from, you know, dealing with war and racial genocide and desperation and revenge and, you know, friendship is a huge theme and familial love and, you know.
Yeah. Well, with a series that long, you're going to broach a lot of subjects.
Right. Well, yeah. It's just really well done, really deep cast of characters, all very well fleshed out. And talking again about, you know, stories for girls, maybe not for young girls, but there are a lot of female characters in there that are also really well done, which is not surprising considering Hiromu Arakawa, I can never pronounce names, is herself a woman. So there's a, you know, she has a little bit of inside track there. But,
yeah.
It's definitely a comic I think everyone should give a go. Even if you've seen the first anime, the first anime is actually completely different. It's one of those instances where they started making the anime while the manga was still being made, hit the point where the manga was completed to that point, and then they're just like, we're gonna make up our own story from here, and it's completely different characterization, completely different themes, everything. It kind of ends on a downer note, and this, despite all of the dark places it does end up going, it actually ends on a really strong, uplifting note, which I think is pretty awesome. I like the uplifting kind of end. Realistically uplifting.
Okay. So. And then?
Lastly, I have a little bit of an agenda in recommending this because we have it here at the library, but look how skinny this is. It's kind of hard to see on a library shelf. This is Murder, She Writes. It's a little self-contained story by John Allison of Scary Go Round and Bad Machinery fame, and stars two characters that are in both of those comics, which are Shelley Winters and Charlotte Grote. It's basically just a kind of goofy murder mystery. Shelley Winters is a children's book writer, and Charlotte is her intern, and they go to a writer's retreat, and people start dying. So Charlotte, being the intrepid young girl she is, solves the murder mystery while everyone else is sort of flailing about and getting drunk and being very absurd. It's got John Allison's signature sense of humor, which is a little bit absurd, very British.
Yeah, a little dry.
Yeah, yeah. You can definitely tell he's from across the pond, which is part of the draw, at least for me. But it's a great little self-contained story. I'm not sure if it's still available on his website. I know with a lot of these kind of self-contained things that he posted, he would put it on the website for a while. Like, he'd serialize it, then take it off, at least, like, with Giant Days. I'm not sure if Murder, She Writes is what that case, but if it is, we have the copy right here at AADL, so you could check it out.
So it's not just a place to get the most popular books. It's a place to get out-of-the-way rare books, too. Very cool. Comics.aadl.org. Thanks, Rachel. Jim, what do you got?
Oh, man. I've got some good ones. All right. I would be totally burned at the stake if I didn't promote my two good buddies first. Jose, the sumo art of Jose Cabrera. Just really, let me find something good here. Really colorful. Amazing, amazing, just craziest art you've ever seen. Jose does not do drugs, but it's just
sumos. Is that a geisha with a lion head?
Yes. I mean, there's sumos in the subway. There's sumos, oh, I like this one. They're fighting over a broken Budweiser bottle. But just...
The colors are amazing.
Drugs. Kids, do this book.
Oh.
You will feel it. Next, I have My Pickle Tastes Funny by Lonnie Millsap. And this book is available at lots of comic book shops and bookstores and things. And I'm going to find a random cartoon. they're all very appropriate. Here's one. It's a Sasquatch dating Sasquatch.com dating disappointment, where he's saying you look much taller in your profile picture.
and much hairier.
It's very farsightish. Very well.
Okay.
And those are my two good buddies. And, you know, you have Jim on your show. They're going to get mentioned. So, got another one, though. I corresponded with this guy and super nice guy, but I was a fan of this guy's work for a long time, and I always promote his stuff whenever I can. But his name's Joe Ullman. This, I think, was his first book, Chewing on Tin Foil. Joe Ullman. His latest one is called Science Fiction, and it's about Chewing on Tin Foil is an anthology. It's a collection of a bunch of short stories, you know, 7-8 page stories, just all kinds of crazy stuff. But this is a good example of his style. Science fiction. It's about a school teacher that is fighting with these repressed memories of what could possibly be an alien abduction. But it's not it's real world stuff, but in a funny, very funny style. And his acting of his characters is so good. The way he draws them, the way they pause, and it's kind of four panel, you know, told in that style. So those are my suggestions, and you'll be happy to purchase any of those.
And we will link to them in the show notes. By the way, everybody, this show will be archived at comicsaregreat.com/CAG96. Jim, thank you so much for hanging out with me for an hour.
Thank you, guys. Thank you. And thank you, Eric, for posting all these links. I'm looking at the live feed, and because, like, we mentioned something. So if I mention, like, NAMBLA, will he post a link to NAMBLA?
Or, he probably will.
No, he's shaking his head back there.
No, he's saying
waving hands. No.
Eric, there's a line, Eric. There's a line. Don't cross that line.
Well, I think these links show up in his Google Plus feed as well, so that's not something he needs to be dropped in there out of context.
I want to promote Al-Qaeda.com. And let's see what else.
But Jim, please say that you'll be back at least to talk about Revengeance when it comes out.
Absolutely, absolutely. And thank you very much. I was looking very forward to this all week. I'm like, oh, okay, I get to be on the show. So it was a thrill. And this is, you're doing the right thing, Jersey. This is a good format for you.
Oh, thanks.
We can see your bright smile. Oh, wait, and one last thing before I go. Somebody wants to say goodbye.
Oh, God.
I had such a good time on the show, and let's just call this the opening act.
And there's some more Puppet Stress Nightmares for me. All right, thank you once again. Jim Lujan can be found at jimlujan.com. Go subscribe to his YouTube page. Go watch Foreverland, Counterclockwise and Foreverland. You won't be sorry. It's a great thing to put on in the background while you're drawing, cartoonists. There's a ton of videos on his YouTube page that you should go check out today. And that's at youtube.com/JimLujan, right?
That's right. And I'm available for ads. Mm. Advertisers out there, I'm available to do advertisements.
Oh.
Check me.
Good to know. Yes. All right, cool. All right, so thanks again to Jim Lujan. You're also Jim Lujan on Twitter and Facebook and all the other social
always
places.
Jim Lujan everywhere.
Always. Thank you to Rachel Moyer for helping out with all the comics events. By the way, this Sunday, April 6th, 1 to 3 p.m. at the Comics Artists Forum, we got Joshua Hoke coming up to do a talk.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be fun.
And then just general hanging out and kvitzing with and kvetching with other cartoonists and schlepping and possibly some other Yiddish words. And thank you to Matthew Bay in the control room and Eric Closter in the control room for putting this show together. Thanks to the Ann Arbor District Library for letting me do this show every 2 weeks. We'll be back in 2 weeks. We're going to talk about Batman next time. We're going to have Cole Glass on again. We're going to nerd out over why Batman is so great. And it should be a fun one. So until then, everybody, I have been Jersey Drozd of ComicsAreGreat.com and Jersey on Twitter. Okay, bye. Is that good, Matt? Matt wasn't paying attention. I'll tell you the things you love about me, Matt. You love my wit, my smile, my sunny disposition. Oh, I didn't think you were listening.
Excellent.
You could always tag that on the end of the episode if you like it.